Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View for Monday evening, March 28th. I'm your wonderful host, PK, and I'll be with you for the next hour discussing the current events and other things that come to mind. Again, I always like to thank bbsradio.com for letting me expand on my free speech. I don't have any pressures from them. I don't have any censorship issues. I have complete internet freedom, if you will. So I'm thankful for that, and keep up the good work, guys, over there in BBS Radio. I'm excited about my guest tonight. It's probably one of my first high-profile guests. It's Professor Jim Fetzer. And Jim is a former Marine Corps officer. He was 4 years commissioned Marine Corps officer. And he was a college professor. He's a retired college professor now, but he taught philosophy and a few other things for over 30 years. He is a fellow truther, a 9/11 skeptic. And I first saw him several years ago, either on an Alex Jones DVD or on the internet or on YouTube. And I was impressed by the way he stood his ground. He deflected name calling or criticism. And so I've always been a fan since then, just based on like his personality. Of course, he has much wisdom and important things to say, but he didn't back down. It's the way he handled it, which is what I liked, which you don't see a lot of that on people in the media or being interviewed. They sometimes cower a little bit or they back away, but not Jim Fetzer, and not me, by the way, either, but I've not had any of his luck as far as some of the media exposures he's had. But anyway, I'm so glad to have him coming on soon. It'll be interesting to see what he's been up to and get his take on things, world events. As you know, trouble's happening there in Libya. And like I said last week, you know, they're making this whole big deal out of Obama and this and that. But you know, folks, Great Britain has the second largest navy in the world. France has a navy, and France has one of the best fighting forces. You know, we make fun of France, but France has the Legion, the French Foreign Legion, and that is one tough bunch of soldiers. So anyway, like I said last week, Britain or France alone could have handled all of this going on in Libya at saving a great expense to the U.S. as if we have to lead everything. Nowhere in the Constitution does it say we're supposed to be the top dog and the world's policeman. And I challenge all of talk radio and Fox News to please show me in the United States Constitution where it says that America is supposed to police the world and the U.S. taxpayer is supposed to endlessly fund policing of the world, to be the world's policeman, and that the U.S. taxpayer is supposed to endlessly fund over 700 military bases in over 140 foreign countries. So back to Libya. Europe gets most of its oil. Europe is its largest customer, especially Italy and France. So let the Europeans handle this. They could do this. We don't need the heavy-handed U.S., which is already broke, spending hundreds of millions, if not billions more, in Libya, blowing up a lot more things beyond what was necessary. And who's going to rebuild this? The U.S. taxpayer? You know, so once again, it's something that we didn't need to be involved in. And as Obama weasels his way into it and out of it, giving us an explanation of what was happening. Well, I'm sorry, there's a lot of, you know, Gaddafi could have slaughtered a lot of people, but that goes for a lot of other countries, that the same sort of thing is going in Bahrain and Saudi, but we're not going to probably jump to their rebels' causes because those are countries that Uncle Sam's tight with, especially the Bushes, Bush family, the oil production. So, you know, the Saudis are friends and they've got huge oil contracts with the U.S. and plus huge huge defense contracts with Britain and the U.S. So, you know, it's just that hypocrisy again. One thing they could have done, for example, is they could have, Britain or France could have, you know, stayed out in international waters with the carriers. They could have brought some Libyan rebels on, provided them with Stinger missiles and anti-tank, you know, weaponry if they're still that handheld sort of stuff, and given them some training, and they could have gone off and done it themselves. But who knows where this is going to bring us. But one thing's for sure, it's going to cost us a hell of a lot of money, money we don't have. Of course, we do have the Federal Reserve, and so they can just print more and create more money. So these are the kind of things that I never back away with. They're all interrelated. And until we understand about how inflation is created by the Federal Reserve System and all this massive deficit spending, we're not going to get a grip on things. And if we think that America's got to be the leader of everything and strut our stuff, meanwhile, we're crumbling at home, you know, it's just not going to work, folks. And I think that imminent financial destruction or the destruction of the dollar or financial collapses, you know, it's on the horizon. We're starting to see the inflation coming in as, you know, the higher prices. You're seeing it not only in gas, but, you know, food prices. Again, prices don't all rise uniformly, but they are starting to rise. You're seeing this price creeping going up. And this is due to inflation. This is creating, you know, more money out of thin air, creating more of a credit expansion. So these are things that enter into our everyday lives, whether we realize it or not. And they're not going away anytime soon. They're only making it worse. Now, the people who can handle this the best are, you know, the well-to-do, the rich, the well-off. I'm not getting down or criticizing the wealthy per se. I'm getting down on the government mechanism that causes this, and it's the federal government that does this. State governments can't print money. The states can't station troops overseas in other foreign countries. The states can't declare war against other countries. Not that Bush or Obama or Clinton have ever done that. You know, this War Powers Act and this, to me, is another way to gut the congressional authority to declare war. So, you know, like Randolph Bourne said years ago, war is the health of the state. And it's benefiting this massive military-industrial complex and those people who are on the corporate welfare gravy train. And all these contractors in Iraq and Afghanistan and this huge, massive military-industrial complex, these people are all paid from our taxes. They might be private companies, but they're all lining up at the tax trough. So, you know, it, to me, I just see it getting worse. I don't see it getting better. I hate to be pessimistic about it, but I'm glad that we have alternative radio, internet radio, to state that these sort of things and to continue the struggle against statism and more government control over our lives. And you're not going to hear this on mainstream, the status quo news media, which of course is Zionist controlled, is very pro-Israel, and which is another big part of the problem. This U.S. propping up Israel with an endless supply of free American-made murder weapons. This all ties in together. So Washington was right when he, in his farewell speech, when he encouraged trade amongst nations with the U.S., but not getting involved in entangling alliances with them. And the further we deviate from that, the further we cause more grief for ourselves, more hatred against the U.S., more bankruptcy. It's kind of comical to watch that commercial about the Chinese. It's fictional, but this Chinese businessman or bureaucrat or politician, he's speaking to a large group of Chinese students, talking about how empires fail and how the U.S. is, you know, making its own mistakes and how much the debt is and how they work for us. And I thought that was kind of prescient. I thought it was kind of funny. I mean, I'm not down on China per se, but these are things that we have to be concerned about. And I think it was it 60 Minutes? I noticed it last night about all these offshore businesses, American corporations. Well, look how high the taxes are. I'm not pro-business per se. I'm pro-free enterprise, and I don't want to tax the wealthy and business more. I want to detax everyone. So that's my message, micro-taxes. Sounds like our guest is here. So, Jim, are you out there?
Yeah, I'm here, PK. How are you doing?
Good. Welcome to the Third Stream View.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
How have you been?
Good. Very good.
Would you like some tea or coffee?
I like your remark that the world knows more about America than Americans know about the world.
That's very true. That's very true.
I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, well, you know, I always liked history as a kid and geography, and I've traveled a lot, so it comes in handy, and it's like those are two of the lost subjects in America.
Yes. Yes, they are.
And part of my
those who are ignorant of history are destined to repeat it.
Oh, that's for sure. And part of my background is, by the way, I also went to IU.
Oh, did you now?
Yes, sir.
What year were you there? What degree did you earn?
Well, unlike you, I didn't graduate. I'm a college dropout.
Okay, that's all right.
But I know it's all right, and I'll tell you why. Or my reasoning is because of that guilt of all those years of that, I have become my own policy wonk and my own intellectual. Because of that guilt of not finishing school. Unlike a lot of my friends who did and are doing well and have families, but they've because of their other duties and whatnot, they're not studying much or reading much. So I've spent all that time I read, I study, I learn. So that this is how I've made up for it. It's my guilt.
Well, you probably have much more functional knowledge about the world than most college graduates because of that, PK.
Well, I think so too, and I'll admit it. And I've paid some dues, and I've struggled a bit, but I have really no regrets, and I continue to read and study. And it's good to be in your company because you're a man of wisdom. I have to say, I liked your approach. I refer to it as I do mine, as you had like a Teflon approach when I've seen you on Fox. I thought when you squared off with Hannity and Combs and Ollie North. You had said something to the effect of you can't outfox me or your terminology.
I explained they had their facts foxed.
Right.
They had their facts foxed. Yeah, meaning they had them mocked up.
That was so cool because you were like Teflon and it just glanced off of you. Didn't have much of a comeback for that. And the other thing I enjoy about you and hearing you speak is, yes, you're a distinguished college professor with all this experience and course education, but you're a regular guy. You're a funny guy. You can take a joke. You're not a stuffed shirt kind of guy. So that's another reason I enjoy, you know, your personality that goes with what you have to say and what you can bring.
That's nice, PK. I'm glad you appreciate that. I'm glad you said that.
Well, I would think that, in fact, in the past, you probably have – maybe students or friends that have felt the same way about your methodology, about the way you do things.
Well, you know, was it Robert Burns who said, "Oh, would a gift the gifty gee us to see ourselves as others see us?" How much more successful we would all be in life if we could appreciate how others perceive us.
Right, right. Well, you seem like the kind of person who, or the kind of teacher would also try to make learning fun, and that you really enjoy what you did. You had a passion for it.
Well, I tried to get my students to come to the point that you arrived at independently, namely being able to sort things out for themselves. You know, I felt I was a facilitator in developing their intellects to the point where they could figure things out on their own. It's like that saying about give a man a fish, you know, and he has a meal, but teach him how to fish, and he's going to have meals for a lifetime.
Yeah, that's very true. I was curious, Jim, what have you been up to lately? You're still an activist, I'm sure. You're doing any speaking lectures or, you know?
Well,
I'm
keeping my hand in quite a few different projects. I just guest edited a special double issue of a philosophy journal, which is Synthes. It's for philosophy of science and methodology and epistemology on evolution and its rivals, which I co-edited with Glenn Branch from the National Center for Science Education. Oh. And today I received a copy of the Dealey Plaza Echo, which is published by the JFK Research Society in the UK, which included an article of mine entitled "Who's Telling the Truth, Clint Hill or the Zapruder Film?" which is reflecting on and spelling out the ramifications of the fact that Clint Hill, who was the agent who was on the left running board of the Secret Service Cadillac, rushed forward to assist during the assassination. He was the only agent who actually actively responded, although John Reddy on the right running board started to respond when Emory Roberts, who was in charge of the detail, called him back. And when you consider what Clint Hill has to say about all the things he did before the vehicle got to the triple underpass, you're just kind of blown away, because he talks about getting up on the vehicle, pushing Jackie back down in the street, lying over her and Jack, looking down into this fist-sized gaping hole in the back of his head, and then turning to his colleagues and giving them the thumbs down all before the limousine reaches the triple underpass. And what's stunning about that, of course, PK, is we don't see any of that in the film. All we see is him on the rear running board. So it's really quite something. He is giving a book tour with a guy named Blaine, who authored this book called The Kennedy Detail, about their experience in guarding JFK as Secret Service agents. And I don't think they have any idea how much they're revealing, because they did an interview at a Warwick bookstore that lasted for 45 minutes. And when Clint Hill described what he'd done, I sent a link to this to a number of my closest associates. And John Costella, who has done a superb collation of the witness reports from Dealey Plaza, realized immediately that what Clint Hill was saying, and which he has been saying consistently for 47 years, if you go back to his written reports and other statements he's made, was inconsistent with the film. So what we have is yet one more proof that the Zapruder film has been fake. I have a more recent piece even on a similar theme that's on my blog. If you go to jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, you can find this piece, which is entitled "Did Zapruder Film the Zapruder Film?" And the point I'm making there is that he cannot have, because the film has been reworked, edited, revised, and no one took a film that's been edited, reworked, or revised. So Zapruder can't have taken the film, because the film's a fake.
Well, Jim, I wish I could believe you guys, but I know damn well that Arlen Specter's single bullet theory has made it all work out for me. That's how I think.
I love that. I love that, PK.
You know, most people don't even know.
Dismembering of the single bullet theory at Cambridge University a few years ago, and then it was published in an international peer-reviewed journal, and you can find it under the heading "Reasoning About Assassinations." You can download it by just entering "Reasoning About Assassinations," and you'll discover how actually the bullet that hit Jack from in the back didn't hit him in the base of the back of the neck. That was a contrivance of Gerald Ford, who was then a Republican congressman from Michigan. He had the description of the wound changed from his uppermost back to the base of the back of the neck, but the uppermost back was already an exaggeration, because the bullet actually hit 5.5 inches down below the collar to the right of the spinal column. It was a shallow shot, only went in about as far as the second knuckle on your little finger at a downward angle of 45 to 60 degrees. And what that means is, I mean, we have all kinds of evidence for this. We have the shirt he was wearing, the jacket he was wearing. We have the autopsy diagram by J. Thornton Boswell. We have an FBI diagram by a fellow named Siebert. We have the president's personal physician. He was a United States Navy Admiral Berkeley, who described this wound as at the level of the third thoracic vertebrae. We have reenactment photographs from the Warren Commission showing a round circular patch well below the collar for the stand-in for JFK. So we know that it's a false claim that it hit at the base of the back of the neck, which, of course, was necessary for this magic bullet to have passed through his neck, exited his throat, got into the back of John Connolly, shattered a rib, exited his chest, impacted his right wrist, and wound up in his left thigh, which is preposterous on its face. But now we know exactly how this fantastic scenario was contrived. And David W. Mantic, MD, PhD, who is, in my opinion, the leading expert on the assassination in the world today, discovered by taking a patient who had similar chest and neck dimensions and doing a CAT scan and plotting the trajectory, that the trajectory isn't even anatomically possible because cervical vertebrae intervene. So that what Senator Spector told us about the magic bullet is not only false and provably false, it's not even anatomically possible. And that's important, PK, because it means that the wound to the throat, which was actually, in fact, an entry wound, and the wounds to John Connolly all have to be accounted for on the basis of other shots and other shooters.
Well, that's interesting. Thank you for that. The Kennedy thing is something I've never really studied much about, but let me give you my summary in a nutshell. I think that Oswald was the patsy. He was somehow probably linked to it. I don't know if he took a shot or not, but I think he was the patsy. And I'm going to tie this into Dr. King. So was James Earl Ray. He was the patsy. And they always have to have their patsy. I think it was the CIA who was involved in this. And I also I wouldn't be surprised at all, and I'll get to them later, because they're one of my main bogeymans, is that Mossad may have been involved in this, because I didn't know that Kennedy fought with Israel's leadership about having nuclear weapons and wanting them to be verified and this or that, or not having nuclear weapons. I didn't know that maybe 10 years ago.
Well, you're certainly correct that Oswald was a patsy, and you're certainly also correct that James Earl Ray was a patsy. And you can go one step further, because Sirhan was also clearly a patsy.
Right.
And I'll just mention a couple of places where I discuss two of those three cases, namely Jack and Bobby. One piece of mine is entitled JFK and RFK, the plots that killed them, the patsies that didn't. And a supplemental piece about Bobby, RFK, outing the CIA at the ambassador. Now, those articles, too, you can either Google or go to my website, my blog at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, and find them. There's also a lot on JFK at another website of mine, assassinationscience.com, which is my public issues website, PK. But I also co-edit an online journal for advanced study of the death of JFK with John P. Costella, who is the leading expert on the Zapruder film, at assassinationresearch.com. So there's a lot of material there. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Oswald wasn't even on the sixth floor, actually. He was down around the second floor, a lunchroom where he was observed by co-workers at 10 minutes at 12, at 12, at 12:15, as late as 12:25 by Carolyn Arnold, who is the executive secretary to the vice president. At 12:30, the assassination took place, and within 90 seconds, a motorcycle patrolman by the name of Marion Baker confronted him in the lunchroom and held him in his sights until Roy Truly, who was his supervisor, came over and identified him as an employee who belonged there. They both made handwritten statements, which were actually published in the 888-page summary report known as the Warren Report, where they explained that he was acting normally. He wasn't out of breath. He wasn't perspiring. He wasn't agitated, except Roy Truly added, a little startled as someone might be to find himself confronting a police officer with a drawn revolver. And Marion Baker added he was drinking a Coke. Now, apparently the timeline was too tight for him to have been on the sixth floor shooting at JFK and then stashing his trusty Mannlicher Carcano in the warehouse as he rushed to four flights of stairs down into the lunchroom to put a nickel into the machine to get out a Coke. In fact, the adrenaline would have been pumping so hard, I don't think he could have got a nickel into the machine. The whole story is a fantasy. But apparently, when they were reconstructing the scenario that the government would propose, they had Officer Baker strike the part about him drinking a Coke. But virtually every serious student of the assassination recognizes that he was drinking a Coke. It's like someone writing down of an encounter with a man and write down that they wrote down that he was wearing a green beret. Well, there's no reason in the world why you'd write a man who was wearing a green beret unless he was wearing a green beret, just as there would be no reason in the world to write down he was drinking a Coke unless he was drinking a Coke.
Right.
The government did a lot of this, PK, of trying to get witnesses to alter their statements or change them. They were particularly brutal with Malcolm Perry, MD, who performed a tracheostomy through the shot to the throat jacket sustained, one of two shots that were fired from in front that were widely broadcast on radio and television that day. During a press conference that was held at 2:16 at the Parkland Hospital, Malcolm Perry three times described this wound as a wound of entry, that the bullet was coming at him and so forth. But the FBI sent some guy down to harass Malcolm Perry, and a nurse, Audrey Bell, said that Saturday morning, remember the assassination took place Friday, so this guy was apparently beating up on Malcolm Perry all night, trying to get him to change his description of the wound from an entry to an exit. And Audrey Bell said that next morning she'd never seen anyone so depressed and defeated as Malcolm Perry was when she saw him that day.
Well, who was pressuring them, CIA, FBI?
Oh, FBI in this case, yeah. We have more than 15 indications of Secret Service complicity in setting him up for the hit. The CIA, military, anti-Castro Cubans, local law enforcement were involved in taking him out. The FBI was used to cover it up. J. Edgar and Lyndon were principals with financing from Texas oilmen. It's a very dark chapter in our history.
So immediately post 9/11, so is this also BS where they were trying to make us think that, well, you know, the CIA and the FBI don't cooperate that closely. There's bureaucratic this and that. I wondered about that. They're probably tighter than we think they are.
Oh, virtually everything the government has told us about 9/11 is false, and the government knows it's false. So we're being sold the big lie here, PK, about 9/11. And anyone who wants to get the skinny on 9/11 should visit 9/11scholars.org. 9/11scholars.org. That's the home page for Scholars for 9/11 Truth, an organization I founded in December of 2005. And in the upper left-hand corner, they'll find a piece entitled Why Doubt 9/11, where I enumerate 20 major findings of researchers, not all members of Scholars. Some of these discoveries were made before I founded the organization, but others by members of Scholars that refute the government's official account of 9/11. And if you go to the right-hand side of the page, you'll see an icon for PatriotsQuestion911.com. And if you go there, you're going to find biographical sketches, photographs, and statements from thousands of experts and professionals across many disciplines and professions, such as, you know, some government people, military people, academicians, scientists, architects and engineers, the whole bit. And you're going to discover the breadth and depth of support for the 9/11 movement. I would say anyone who's taken a serious look into 9/11 and has become familiar with the evidence recognizes that it was a con job. It was largely fake. There were even special effects. Let me give you one illustration, PK. There were two lime green civilian fire trucks that extinguished the fire from the alleged plane crash at the Pentagon. Actually, a plane flew toward the building and then swooped over it, but they were there to extinguish fires from explosions that were set off at the same time to create the impression of a crash. So they put out these modest fires in about 15 or 20 minutes. The lawn, by the way, when they're doing this, is all perfectly clear and green and unblemished, so you expect Tiger to show up with his caddy to practice his putting. But well, Jim, hours later, there was a rumor that the Capitol was going to be hit. So all the congressmen, the senators and representatives came rushing out onto the steps. And when they looked across the Potomac, they saw these billowing black clouds coming up to the Pentagon, which was intended to create the psychological impact of this massive attack. But in fact, PK, it turns out all that massive black smoke was coming from a series of enormous dumpsters in front of the Pentagon. None of it was coming from the building itself.
Wow. Jim, it's not like the Pentagon had probably 80 or so cameras observing the Pentagon building itself.
That's right. There are 84 cameras. 84 cameras, and yet the Pentagon is, you know, only under duress. They eventually released three versions, but none of the three versions showed anything more than five frames they released initially, and four of the frames were just fireballs.
And it looked like a little silver streak.
One of the frames was conveniently labeled plane. If you study it, just above the gate mechanism, there's a little figure of a plane. Jack White, who's a legendary photo analyst of JFK, but also a student of 9/11, sized a Boeing 757 for me to the same scale as the tail. And the 757, which is 156 feet long, was more than twice as long as this little plane there. So it couldn't possibly be a 757. It's a much smaller plane. It has a white plume trailing from it. That is, after consulting with pilots and aeronautical engineers, has led me to conclude that it's possible that the building might have been hit by a much smaller plane that fired a missile. The reason for this being that Donald Rumsfeld had announced the day before Monday, before 9/11, on 9/10, that the Pentagon had lost track of $2.3 trillion from its budget. So what I believe was happening here is that he had these budget experts, financial analysts, and accountants with all those documents and records in this particular part of the building, which had just been refurbished and reinforced, so that the attack, you know, these alleged terrorists were actually attacking the most invulnerable part of the Pentagon, the place where it would do the least damage, where it was practically bereft of files and personnel because of the construction. But where they could take out just these accountants and financial analysts and all the records for the missing $2.3 trillion. I counted up of the 125 casualties at the Pentagon, about three dozen are these financial experts. So I think it was all very carefully contrived to eliminate all those experts and all the records for the missing $2.3 trillion.
Well, therefore, as I summarize this, Jim, and I think you'll agree, therefore, the Warren report is about as accurate as the 9/11 report.
Right. I put it the other way around, of course, since the Warren came first, but you're absolutely right. They're on a par. They're both a whitewash. In fact, this fellow, Philip Zelikow, who was responsible for the 9/11 Commission report, had a draft completed a year before he shared it with any member of the staff. It turns out, and I was astonished to discover this, that his area of academic specialization is the creation and maintenance of public myths, M-Y-T-H-S, PK. So
another cast
for this role of creating a fantasy to sell to the American people. That was his area of expertise.
Jim, another Cass Sunstein?
Cass Sunstein, yeah.
He's a
Harvard professor who has suggested the infiltration of 9/11 truth movements. It's very bad. I published an article about Cass Sunstein entitled Birds of a Feather, Subverting the Constitution at Harvard Law, which was published in Op-Ed News, and you can find that again if you do a Google search. I mean, very bad. You know, this guy has now a position in the Obama administration. I got to say, PK, how much of a disappointment this guy Obama has proven to be. When he was a candidate, I thought because of his background in constitutional law, you know, he was the president of the Harvard Review, he was a professor at the University of Chicago, that he was just the right guy to get our country back on a firm constitutional footing. So I expected that when he came into government, he would move to rescind the Patriot Act, abolish the Military Commissions Act, close Guantanamo, get us out of Iraq and Afghanistan, where we're conducting these wars in violation of international law, the UN Charter, and even the U.S. Constitution. And instead, he's done none of those things. He's actually sent 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan and justified on the ground that we're looking for Osama bin Laden. But that's ridiculous, PK. Osama bin Laden died about 15 December 2001. In fact, David Ray Griffin, who's the leading student of 9/11, has published a whole book about it entitled Osama bin Laden Dead or Alive. But I put out press releases about the phony video and audio tapes that were being released that obviously have been fabricated by the CIA, where we had experts confirming that what was being said, or the figure being presented, was not, in fact, Osama bin Laden, on the basis of multiple considerations. And if you go to 911scholars.org, if you just click on press releases, you can find a whole lot of press releases that I authored for the Society, including very interesting stuff about the Zacharias Moussaoui trial, where this guy was actually, you know, he was alleged to be the 20th hijacker. He was actually convicted in 2005 of participating in a plot to free the blind sheik who was implicated in the 1993 attempt to attack the Twin Towers.
Right.
A year, and he affirmed that he had nothing to do with 9/11. But a year later, he was being tried again in Alexandria, Virginia, the federal courthouse, to determine whether he should receive life imprisonment or the death penalty, on the ground that if he'd only come forward to reveal the plot on 9/11, that they might have saved lives. This was fantastic on many grounds. It was a shell game being played by federal prosecutors. There's no legal obligation to come forward and incriminate yourself. We still have something called the Fifth Amendment. This whole thing was an elaborate charade, and while he was there, PK, he was equipped with a 10,000-volt stun belt. I mean, this is really ridiculous. I mean, what has become of this country?
Well, I'll tell you what's ridiculous, Jim. You know, why do they have to torture these guys and everything? Haven't they figured out that Osama bin Laden pulled this off with a laptop in his cave in Afghanistan? That's how it happened.
I know. Now, I sometimes, Jim, make the point, you know, there's no evidence. There's an Icelandic, now German scholar by the name of Elias Davidson, D-A-V-I-D-S-S-O-N, who is published about the government having no proof that any of these hijackers were actually aboard any of these planes. I mean, it's stunning stuff. Just as David Ray Griffin has published articles in Global Research demonstrating that all these phone calls that were allegedly made, there were some 19 persons who were supposed to have made phone calls from these flights, were all fake. They're all fake. Yeah. And, you know, you start to put this together and you realize something very, very, very smelly is going on here, and it has many, many aspects to it. But I've sometimes remarked, you know, how did these guys get aboard these planes? Did Osama Laden charge them to his MasterCard from his cave in Afghanistan?
Probably. Or the Carlyle Group paid for it.
Yeah, now, right. That's more like it.
Let me
the
give you my
group. Yeah, that's a
Jim,
good
let me
one.
Give you let me give you my brilliant brief description of Obama. Obama, back to Obama, that you were thinking, yeah. Oh, this guy, you know, what you were just saying before, how you thought, well, he might fix this stuff and this and that, but, you know, he's kind of reversed himself. Therefore, Jim, and the rest of the world, Obama may just as well be a mulatto, mixed race, blue blood, skull and bones member.
Well, you know, I have said of his administration that he's a, you know, or of Obama, that he's a Bush in blackface, or that, you know, this is Bush light, L-I-T-E. I mean, I'm very distraught about all this. I was very supportive of Obama. I thought he was going to make a real difference, and it's been, you know, very, very disappointing to me. And now, of course, this intervention in Libya, I mean, it's bad enough that we're in Iraq and Afghanistan, and now we're in Libya, too. I mean, what in the world is going on here?
Well, see, I didn't vote in 08 because I didn't like either one of them. And, of course, they did everything they could to blackball Ron Paul. But I've said from the get-go.
Yeah, we can talk about Ron Paul. I must say, though, you know, who are you going to vote for if you didn't vote for Obama? I mean, I actually published an article about John McCain that was entitled John McCain Mentally, Morally, Emotionally Unfit.
Well, we know that.
The guy would have been a disaster. You couldn't make him president of the United States. And then to have somebody as completely unqualified as Sarah Palin as the vice president, I mean, that was a no-brainer, you know. I mean, Ron Paul is such a fascinating guy. And now, of course, with Rand Paul in the Senate, this is a very interesting situation, PK.
Jim, back to McCain, though. You have to admit that he married well.
He married well. Yeah. I like his wife, Cindy. You mean with a short, short hair. Yeah. She's a great looking gal. Yeah, I don't remember if that was his first wife, but she's a wonderful looking gal.
It was his second.
Yeah.
But
I like Cindy.
Back to another description I have of Obama, which I said, you know, three years ago or so. Obama is Bush 3 with a makeover on steroids. When I hear Obama and I see Obama speak, I do not see a mulatto mixed race president. I see and hear a smooth talking lawyer who remains clueless about economics, economic history, and political economy. That's what I see and hear.
Well, I'd have a hard time disputing that, PK, and then keeping. Look at the key players he kept over from the Bush administration. I mean, you got the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates. You got the Director of the FBI, Robert Mueller. And he kept these economists, you know, to have people like Larry Summers hanging around or Bernanke. I mean, I'm very upset with these guys. And what's the Timothy Greiner? These are people who have helped to tank the economy. I mean, along with that Paulson guy, who was a really disgusting cretin. I'm telling you, we've had some raw deals coming from very powerful figures in finance and Wall Street.
I love the way how it's so trendy in the last several years to have that American flag pin on their lapel. Everybody, both sides of the one government party with two heads, or the one bird of prey with two wings.
Yeah.
Now,
like that either. That's very abusive of something that's supposed to stand for something. You know, that symbol, that flag is supposed to stand for something. But when I look around, you know, what America has been doing to the world, I mean, you can go back quite a while if you go to, you know, we talk about freedom and democracy, but we're out there destabilizing governments and assassinating leaders. Chile, Guatemala, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Afghanistan, Iraq. We did it in Iran a whole long time ago. It's terrible, PK.
You sound like you're a fan of, and rightly so, of Smedley Butler.
Well, he was one of the truly great Marine Corps generals. He was a two-time Congressional Medal of Honor winner. He, of course, there was an attempt to recruit him by wealthy financial interests to lead a crusade against FDR and to actually bring about a coup where Smedley was going to be made the head of the government. Smedley played along until he got the goods on him and then turned him in, basically. I don't believe they were actually prosecuted, but it was very embarrassing to these very powerful people. He published a book. It's more like a pamphlet entitled about
War is a Racket.
War is a Racket, right, where he was lamenting how the Marine Corps had been used during his history to promote the profit margins of American corporations. And what it reflects, PK, is that when some other country, you know, wants to nationalize its resources, this is what Allende was doing in Chile, what Castro did in Cuba, what Cesar Chavez did in Venezuela. And the Americans lose, you know, their control of the natural resources of these countries. It's cutting into their profit margins, so they complain and call them communists. Well, these people, for the most part, were actually nationalists. They were trying to use the resources of their country to benefit their own countrymen. But anything that leads a corporation to lose profits, you know, that's the occasion for calling those who bring that about communists.
Jim, I want to interrupt here a minute. I want to thank my friend Richard for hooking me up with the way to get in touch with you. I'd like to tell you again that I appreciate what you did, Richard. I know you're listening. And also, I have a question, Jim. Would you happen to know about the April Gallup case about the Pentagon 9/11 issue? Do you think that this will be the Jim Garrison for 9/11, and will it succeed?
Well, April Gallup was a civilian employee, a black woman who actually was there on 9/11 in the Pentagon with her infant daughter. And when the explosion took place, I mean, you know, which was, of course, supposed to be the plane crash, but there was a huge hole in the office in her immediate vicinity. And she actually went out of the building through this huge hole and couldn't see any indications of any plane having crashed there. I mean, that's one of the ways we know the whole story is a fraud. These planes, a 757, like Flight 77 was supposed to be, weigh about 100 tons. There should have been a massive pile of aluminum debris. There should have been wings. The tail should have been broken off. You should have seats, bodies, luggage. None of that was true. They never even recovered the engines, which are virtually indestructible. So April Gallup was just the right person in the right time, right place at the right time to refute the official account, because she saw and reported seeing no indications whatsoever of any plane having crashed there.
Well, she must hate America then for saying something like that.
I guess if you speak the truth, that's un-American in the eyes of some. You know, those people are trying to manipulate us. I've encountered this in relation to JFK, but relation to 9/11, and also the plane crash that took the life of Senator Paul Wellstone, which gave control of the Senate to the Republicans at the crucial time of going into Iraq. So, you know, there's a lot about Paul Wellstone, by the way, on my public issues website at assassinationscience.com.
Well, that's right. That's where I use my Hannity impression. Why do you hate America? Why do you hate America?
That's right. Why do I hate America?
And I have a great answer for that. Well, Sean, let me clarify something. I don't hate America, but I do hate the federal government, which wrecks things at home and abroad. It continues to wreak havoc at home and abroad, Sean.
Yes.
You know, that's the problem.
Jim, you're right.
I want to patronize you here for a minute. The fact that you are a former Marine Corps commissioned officer of 4 years.
Yeah.
So if anybody has the right to speak his mind, it's our vets and our veterans. And oddly enough, they're out there supposedly defending our rights, but they don't even have free speech while they're doing it.
You're right. The treatment that the veterans are coming back from, Gulf One, and now, of course, Iraq and Afghanistan have been given by the Veterans Administration has been deplorable. I mean, they denied this so-called Gulf Syndrome, which is apparently major effects from the exposure to depleted uranium. It's very serious stuff. We're using.
Jim, you got to back up, though. You got to back up. It's that cocktail of vaccines they gave the troops.
Well, that's probably right too, PK. You mix that with depleted
uranium and all that pollution, and that's probably definitely the case of that. Jim, something I realize is that. And you being a veteran and Marine Corps guy, you might appreciate this. And, of course, I'm thankful to your service and, you know, the bravery of our serving people. I appreciate their service and their bravery. Okay, but now foreign policy is another issue, and I will never back down from any veterans about discussing foreign policy and being harshly critical about foreign policy. And you know what? Well, I've had a lot of discussions with vets and friends. They never get mad at me. They never get upset with me when we talk about these things.
I expect we share many views in common about foreign policy, PK. I'm right there with Ron Paul on foreign policy. I think,
of course,
the libertarians have a very intelligent approach to foreign policy. I mean, but I have differences with you about the social welfare safety net, because I believe that Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment insurance, workman's compensation, all those kinds of programs are essential to make capitalism tolerable for the average working man and woman. But on foreign policy, I'm right there with Ron Paul and Rand Paul.
Well, okay. Well, let's back up a little bit about these, the former things you said, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. I'm with you as far as my caring and compassion for people, but I would rather see it reformed in a more efficient system that doesn't have this poverty pentagon of all these bureaucrats where people still get help and care, but they're not dependent on at least the federal government for all these things. The same government who launches wars, who censors, who kills people. You know, so
the problem with privatization, PK, is that in the first place, the cost of overhead goes up dramatically for the obvious reason. I mean, you know, they've had studies to show that if you got a program like Social Security, it costs the government about 2% to administer it. But if you privatize it, it jumps up to 12% for the obvious reason that the private entity has the profit, the 10% profit margin. So it's going to be more costly. And the private entity is going to try to cut corners and exclude persons from coverage for pre-existing conditions and a whole host of other things that are going to be unfair to American families and American workers. So I really don't agree about privatizing programs like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And Social Security, of course, if you privatize it, it turns it to be a crapshoot because you put it into stocks and bonds, and then, you know, Wall Street makes fabulous sums of money on every transaction, but the American people turn out to be the losers. I think it's, you know, it's been the most successful program in American history, and claims about its alleged insolvency in 35 years or whatever are easily resolved by simply raising the cap on the Social Security tax. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that there's any problem with Social Security that couldn't be solved by simply raising the cap. But right now, I guess it's something like $88,000. Well, if you raise it to $100,000 or $110,000, all these programs just disappear. We got a bizarre situation going on here in Wisconsin now, PK. I reside south, a small town south of Madison. We got a new governor who's an extremist. I mean, this guy's a real reactionary. He has tried to use, he's tried to pull the classic Republican ploy of running up deficits and then trying to use solving the deficit, balancing the budget to slash all the programs that enhance the quality of life for ordinary Americans. And he's tried to do that here in Wisconsin. I mean, you can't believe he's slashing nearly $1 billion from public education, for example. He rejected $800 million that the government was going to give for a high-speed rail plan between Milwaukee and Madison. He's undermined a green furnace at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's undermining the windmill energy program here. He appears to be doing all this, and he wants to sell off 32 state-owned power plants. And there's a provision in his budget plan that says he can do it without competitive bidding, with no supervision, and whatever he does is by law in the state interest. Well, it turns out he's been promoted by a couple of billionaires known as the Koch brothers, spelled K-O-C-H, gas and oil and coal interests in Wisconsin. And if he were to sell these power plants to the Koch brothers, they'd have a vertical monopoly. And I can't begin to imagine what would happen to the prices that those who are consumers of that energy would have to pay to the Koch. So it looks like a nice payoff because they supported his campaign. They gave $43,000, which was the personal limit, directly, but they also gave $1 million to the Republican Governors Association, which turned around and spent something like $3.4 million attacking his opponent. And what's ironic about all this, PK, is Wisconsin has a long history of progressivism and labor rights and the union movement, and he's trying to crack collective bargaining here and doing a whole lot of really atrocious things. I'm really just shocked. All the things that make Wisconsin a wonderful place to live are programs he's unfunding. And get this, he's not only taking away about $1 billion from public education, but it's another draconian aspect of the law he's trying to pass, and it has a very complicated history here, is that the cities are not going to be allowed to raise property taxes even if they want to raise them to maintain the quality of their schools. So, you know, He's gutting the very features that make a state like Wisconsin attractive to companies. He claims it's doing it to bring more companies here, but two-thirds of the companies in Wisconsin already don't pay any income tax at all, period. And if you've got public education, why would anyone want to move to Wisconsin if it was gutted from public education?
Right, right. Well, Jim, I can tell that this is a topic that you and I would have a lot of debate on, but let me just address what you've said very briefly, and that is that there are very good libertarian market solutions to still do these things, and a lot of this privatization should also include massive tax cuts to the people. I'm no fan of the Kochs because they've sold out. They're pretty much neocons. They don't like Murray Rothbard and the Ludwig von Mises Institute. They don't like Ron Paul. They used to be more libertarian in scope, but now they're friendly with the neoconservatives and that whole crowd. I'm running out of time, but I wanted to hit on 9/11 again, Jim. I wanted to give you my synopsis of it. I personally believe I've come to the conclusion that I believe that Mossad's fingerprints are all over 9/11, and this helped generate the war in Iraq. Which Iraq, I don't know if, as smart as you are, Jim, I don't know if you know what Iraq stands for.
Well, idiotic. Let me just say that I gave a speech at a Ron Paul Freedom Rally on April 15, 2008. On the grass in front of the Capitol, and it was entitled 9/11 and the Neocon Agenda, where I explained that 9/11 appeared to be motivated by three considerations. One was oil, taking control of Iraqi oil, which can be beneficial in two different ways. You can either take it out of the ground cheap and then sell it dear, or you can leave it in the ground and elevate the price of all the other supply. Israel, because here we were dismantling the most sophisticated modern Arab state, which had a wonderful national health care system, public education, viable infrastructure, reliable water, electricity, museums and antiquities dating back thousands of years, which Israel resented in particular or especially because Saddam was providing $25,000 bounties to the families of suicide bombers, but more importantly, they wanted to dismantle the most sophisticated modern Arab state so they could expand the political influence of Israel uncontested without competition from this modern state. Of course, ideology, because the neocons believe that with the demise of the Soviet Union and the United States being the sole remaining superpower, that there was an opportunity to move an American presence into this sensitive geopolitical area and project it outward, both military and diplomatic. And you're absolutely right. The Mossad had a very important role here. I must say, in relation to JFK, I have seen no indications that Israel was involved, although it's true that JFK and Ben-Gurion had differences because Ben-Gurion wanted to develop Israeli nuclear energy and weapons, and JFK was opposed to that. But I have seen no indication that Israel was involved in the assassination of JFK. If you want to learn a lot about JFK, there are two books I'd recommend. One is by a fellow named James Douglas, D-O-U-G-L-A-S-S, entitled JFK and the Unspeakable, which explains how he antagonized some of the most powerful special interests in the country during his administration. And the other is a book by a guy named Phil Nelson entitled LBJ, Mastermind of JFK's Assassination, which shows how they dealt with it by taking him out, where LBJ was the pivotal player. I have absolutely no doubt about this. Now, regarding 9/11, however, I think you're absolutely right in that it was a combination of neocons, many of whom had joint U.S.-Israeli citizenship.
Oh, that's most of them do. Wolfowitz, Pearl, that whole crowd. I know a lot about this.
And one
other thing, you talked about Israel not, you know, resenting Iraq. They resented Iraq because Iraq had the largest Arab army in the Middle East.
Therefore, Iraq
has two definitions. Iraq stands for idiotic Republican authorized quagmire, or Israeli requested American quagmire. Now Iran stands for Israel requires American naivety.
Yeah.
Now let's complete this.
Let's make a quick point here, PK. Why shouldn't Iran have the bomb? I mean, Israel has something between 200 and 600 of these little beauties. Why shouldn't Iran have a few of them? They couldn't possibly use them for offensive purposes without confronting national annihilation. On the other hand, they serve as a deterrent to a state that would attack them because they would know that as a consequence, they might suffer a rather painful outcome by being nuked themselves. So I'm all for Iran having a few of these bombs.
I'm not worried. I'm more worried about Israel. Israel is the problem. With all their nukes, they could hit Europe. They could hit Russia. They're much scarier to me. Therefore, AIPAC, you know what that great organization, you know that term, don't you?
Sure,
AIPAC.
Of course.
American Israeli Parasites Against the Constitution.
By the way, if anyone wants to go to my Facebook page, James Henry Fetzer, they'll find a couple of recent articles, including one from an historian in Israel, talking about how Israel has all of the European nations targeted, and that Israel, if it ever thinks it's going to go down, is going to take the whole world with it. I'm sorry to say that I believe this is their mindset, that there's a lunacy that prevails in Israeli politics.
And, of course, any criticism of Israel, Jewish power, Zionism, you're automatically anti-Semitic. Well, I like the new term of anti-Semite. An anti-Semite is a person that Jews don't like.
That's right.
And I'm not afraid to talk about Zionism.
You're absolutely right. Zionism is the problem. You're absolutely correct. Zionism is the problem. This quest for a greater Israel, taking control of the whole Middle East and all that. There are all kinds of bizarre fantasies that motivate Zionism, and it's all bad. It's very bad for the world. It's one of the greatest cancers, scourges on the face of the earth, I'm sorry to say, Zionism. And
it's
of course,
true.
You know, I wrote a long time ago that when Jews start acting like Nazis, we're in trouble. And of course, they've been doing that in relation to the Palestinians for quite a long time, where Gaza is now the world's largest concentration camp. It's appalling.
Well, America had no enemies in the Middle East prior to 1948.
Yes.
When Israel was forced on those other countries. And I long for the
I
day
know,
when
this
Israel...
Was a, this was a huge, huge mistake. You're absolutely right, PK. I agree completely.
I usually am. And I look forward to the day when Israel gets its boot off of America's neck.
I know. There's much, much too much. You know, it's like Obama's running the Israeli foreign policy. It's like the Israeli tail is wagging the American dog. It's appalling. And the sooner we emancipate ourselves from Zionist control, the better off we and the rest of the world will be.
Well, Jim, it's getting time. I got to wrap the show up. I want to thank you so much again for coming on. I hope you enjoyed your brief stay here at Third Stream View.
I certainly did, PK. I very much appreciate it. Anytime, I'd be glad to come back.
I would love to have you come back soon because I want to talk to you about more about the whole Middle East thing and Israel, this situation. And also,
sure.
I know since you're a college professor and, of course, that background, I would like to discuss more of this thing about Wisconsin and all, you know, the things you brought up, because there are libertarian ways to address these things.
Anytime, BK, I'd be delighted. Okay.
Thank you so much, Jim. I'll talk to you in the future. Appreciate it so much.
You got it. My great pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. And I'd like to thank again my listeners for tuning in here at Third Stream View, and I'd like to thank Jim Fetzer for coming on. I enjoyed speaking with him. You can tell this fellow's he's got a wealth of knowledge, he's done his homework, and he has a passion for what he does, and that's really the defining part of it. You can have information, and you can know a lot, but passion is really what puts it all together. And Jim certainly has a lot of that, and he knows his stuff, so that was great. I really appreciate that. So, again, until next week, I'm signing off for now, but I'll see you next Monday, 9 o'clock Pacific, 11 o'clock Eastern, 11 o'clock Central, 12 o'clock Eastern. Until then, it's your wonderful host, humble host, PK, saying good night. Talk to you next time. Goodbye, everybody.